Good morning. This is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with the Sunday, June 14th reading of the New York Times. Kennedy Center removes Trump's name from facade. The arts institution followed a judge's order to take President Trump's name off its facade. It had been granted a 12-hour extension to complete the work. By Elizabeth Williamson and Julia Jacobs. After a night of storms, both political and meteorological, workers removed President Trump's name from the white marble facade of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts early on Saturday morning, responding to a federal judge's ruling that its rebranding was unlawful. The letters began coming down just past 3 a.m. after the center was granted an extension of a midnight deadline. Matt Floca, center's executive director, attributed the delay to a cluster of summer storms. On Saturday morning, he filed a sworn declaration with the court confirming that Mr. Trump's name had been removed. Workers spent about 8 hours on Friday building towering scaffolding in front of the section of the facade bearing Mr. Trump's name. Then, in the early hours of Saturday, they hung heavy white tarps from the structure. It obscured views of the removal, which was a significant symbolic victory for opponents of Mr. Trump's takeover of an iconic performing arts center. But a gap in the tarps allowed a New York Times photographer to observe a worker pulling the letter A from the wall. The signage had read the Donald J. Trump and the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts. There was no sound of power tools. The letter appeared to come off by hand. For all of Friday, lawyers for Mr. Trump and the center had been seeking legal intervention to keep his name on the marble as they pursue an appeal. But after both the district court and a federal appeals court denied their request for an immediate stay on the ruling, workers began erecting scaffolding in earnest to reach the letters. A rowdy audience of a few hundred people gathered to watch. The center's Trump-allied board voted to add the president's name to the institution nearly 6 months ago, causing an uproar in Washington and a crisis within the city's preeminent arts center. At an institution that had already been rocked by the president's takeover, the 18 new letters affixed to the building less than a day after the board vote increased the temperature even further. Democratic legislators condemned the move as an act of narcissism. A series of artists canceled engagements at the center, and Representative Joyce Beatty, a Democrat of Ohio and ex officio member of the center's board, filed a lawsuit calling the move a flagrant violation of the rule of law. Ms. Beatty was on hand for the operation on Saturday morning, remaining on the plaza outside the Kennedy Center even after the work crew departed around 4 a.m. The ensuing debate over the appropriateness of the renaming led to a bizarre scene in Washington, where for 2 days the Arts Center on the Potomac River saw a flurry of visitors, not there for a symphony or ballet, but to see whether the president's name would be detached from the marble. While onlookers kept watch, a steady drumbeat of legal developments drove a sense of uncertainty over whether the removal would happen at all. On Thursday, one of the first signs of movement came when security guards erected black bike racks to close off the main drive and walkway near the front of the building. Passersby quizzed volunteers and guards inside the center about when the letters would come off, with little success. A short walk from the Kennedy Center, residents of the Watergate were planning impromptu house parties at the sprawling condominium complex. Two volunteer organizations, Hands Off the Arts and Free the Kennedy Center, coordinated to live-stream the signage on the building from a webcam situated on a balcony at the Watergate. Christine Leinert and Deborah Wilfong kept their celebratory champagne on ice until 10:30 p.m. on Thursday. As news emerged that Mr. Trump's name would not be coming off the building that night, they slipped the bubbly back into the fridge. On Friday, Ms. Leinert reloaded the cooler and joined the throng awaiting the letter's removal. but after news spread that Mr. Trump's name might not be removed for hours, they packed up her champagne, the ice in her cooler having long melted. Not everyone who milled around the Kennedy Center was opposed to keeping Mr. Trump's name on the building. Jeanette Mercado and her husband, Bert, had traveled to Washington from Wasco in California's Central Valley to see the Capitol's monuments and came upon the scaffolding and the gathering crowd. I like Trump. I like what he's doing for our country. I think he's a blessing for our country, and I don't see anything wrong with his name being added, Ms. Mercado said, her voice almost drowned out by chants of "take it down." Mr. Mercado, who said he was also a Trump supporter, took a different view. There should be a sense of continuity here. Why are you going to interject your name, he said. In December, the Kennedy Center board voted to put Mr. Trump's name on the building in recognition of what officials have described as his dedication to the institution and his help in securing $257 million to finance what officials said was a much-needed renovation. When Judge Christopher R. Cooper of Federal District Court in Washington ruled on Ms. Beatty's suit last month, he found that the board did not have the power to unilaterally rename the institution. That power lies only with Congress, he wrote in his order, citing legislation enacted in 1964 that dedicated the institution to Kennedy, a supporter of the arts who had advocated its establishment. The Trump Kennedy Center label adds an entirely new name to the center's formal title, Judge Cooper wrote, and relegates President Kennedy's name to second place. The judge gave the center until Friday, a two-week deadline, to restore the original name to the building and all official materials. In declining to suspend his own deadline on Friday, Judge Cooper noted that the Kennedy Center had already taken steps to comply with the ruling. Last week, employees were told to immediately change forms, social media accounts, and email signatures. Mr. Trump's name was soon scrubbed from the top of the center's official website. These efforts undermine the notion that defendants face irreparable harm in complying with the order in full, the judge wrote. When the Kennedy Center asked the appeals court to grant a stay, it argued in part that removing the president's name now, only to restore it later, would be incredibly confusing for the public. The motion filed with the appeals court discussed legal technicalities and precedent, but it also contained an opening salvo written in a style that called to mind the president's own cadence, punctuation choices, and penchant for self-promotion. Signed by Brett A. Shumate, an assistant attorney general at the Justice Department, the motion warned that removing the name would seriously threaten fundraising at the center because many donors who had given millions of dollars were only willing to do so with the name Trump on the building. Many did it, the filing added, because they loved the concept of two great presidents, one Republican, one Democrat, working together as one. In many ways, a bipartisan relationship. Lawyers for Ms. Beatty countered that the appeal was filed at the 11th hour in a transparent effort to jam the court and game the judicial system. Judge Cooper's rulings have threatened to undermine Mr. Trump's effort to transform Washington's cultural landscape. At the start of his second term, he made the Kennedy Center a centerpiece of that vision. He commandeered the institution from the inside, purging the board of Biden appointees and installing loyalists who quickly voted him in as chairman. And he began to remake it from the outside, ordering aesthetic changes to the building, such as painting the gold columns white to fit his tastes. For the center's marquee event, the Kennedy Center Honors, he stepped in as MC. In February, Mr. Trump announced his intention to close the institution for 2 years, a decision he said was intended to address serious maintenance problems at the building. The lawsuit filed by Ms. Beatty also objected to the planned closure. Her suit questioned whether it was actually designed to obfuscate the plummeting ticket sales and the flight of artists. After months of legal sparring, Judge Cooper agreed to temporarily block the closure. He found that the board had made an ill-informed and seemingly preordained decision in voting to approve the president's plans. But he said that if the board members were to give serious consideration to the issue, he would not continue to block them. Trump-allied officials at the Kennedy Center immediately announced that they would fight the ruling over the name change, saying they were confident that the court would uphold the board's will to recognize President Trump's historic contributions to our nation's cultural center. The plans for an appeal grew less certain after Mr. Trump responded to the judge's ruling with a tirade on social media. Unless he had control over the center's affairs, Mr. Trump wrote, he had no interest in continuing what could only be a hopeless journey into Never Never Land. The president's name appeared not only on the front of the building, but on letterhead, posters, and directional signs. This week, a parking lot sign had white tape pasted over the word Trump, while one of the center's shuttle buses had it scribbled over in black marker. But then the center's board voted to pursue an appeal. On Friday, Allerton Kilborn, 79, brought a book to occupy him while he waited for what he hoped would be the removal of Mr. Trump's name. He had traveled to the Kennedy Center from his home in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and wound up staying on the grounds for more than 12 hours, roving between the scene outside and the air-conditioned center. "For the adventure of it, this is history," he said. "I'm so old that I once met John Kennedy and have been an enormous fan of his," he said. He said he thought the addition of Mr. Trump's name had been a desecration of the memorial to Kennedy. "I'm not religious," he said, "but I see it in religious terms." Trump says peace deal will be signed Sunday, but Iran disputes timeline. An Iranian foreign ministry official sought to temper expectations, saying there were no plans for a Sunday signing and an agreement could be inked in the coming days. President Trump said the United States and Iran would sign a peace deal on Sunday, though Iran's foreign ministry publicly cautioned that that timeline could be slower. The deal is scheduled to get signed tomorrow, and immediately after it is signed, the Hormuz Strait is open to all, Mr. Trump said in a post on his social media platform on Saturday. The post came hours after the Prime Minister of Pakistan, key mediator in the negotiations, said the country was preparing for the electronic signing of the peace deal, followed by technical-level talks next week. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Ismail Pagay, said on Saturday that there were no plans for an Iranian negotiating team to travel to Geneva or elsewhere in the next day or two, according to IRIB, Iran state broadcaster. The remarks appeared to push back on reports that Iranian officials could soon travel abroad to finalize or sign a memorandum of understanding with the United States as the two sides try to move toward an agreement to end the recent hostilities. The signing of the Iran agreement, if it happens, is likely to be done electronically rather than in person. We don't yet have insight into the reasoning behind the anticipated arrangement. Typically, a diplomatic agreement like this would be signed at an in-person ceremony between the parties. Trump is expected to remain in Washington on Sunday, which is his 80th birthday, to attend the UFC fight at the White House. Now both President Trump and Pakistan, which has been mediating the conflict, have said a U.S.-Iran agreement will be signed tomorrow, but Iran has yet to publicly confirm this. Earlier today, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman told state news signing would not be on Sunday, but could take place in the coming days. Even with U.S. help, little oil has gone through the Strait of Hormuz. President Trump said more than 200 commercial vehicles had safely traveled through the strait. That's still fewer than before the start of the war. By Peter Eavis. Even as the United States tried to negotiate an end to the war with Iran and open the Strait of Hormuz, President Trump said the U.S. military had been helping ships and oil move through the crucial waterway. But while the United States appears to be doing more to get ships through the strait, its efforts have not led to a big recovery in shipping traffic. The number of ships passing through the strait every day is still far lower than it was before the war with Iran began, and the volumes of oil apparently going through are also well below pre-war totals, according to independent tanker tracking firms. The conflict escalated this week before the United States and Iran appeared to move closer to reaching a ceasefire deal that would open the strait and end the U.S. naval blockade on Iran. Abbas Araghchi, the Iranian foreign minister, said in a live televised address to the country on Friday that the agreement with the United States was in its final stages. Mr. Araghchi said that although all commercial ships would be guaranteed safe passage through the strait, Tehran would maintain its control of the waterway and eventually charge a service fee for vessels passing through, an arrangement the Trump administration has opposed. From the start of the war, Iran has used threats and attacks to deter ship operators from sending their oil and gas tankers through the strait. As ship traffic dwindled, the supply of oil to the world declined, causing gasoline and diesel prices to soar. As long as Iran can suppress tanker traffic and keep fuel prices uncomfortably high, it has leverage against the United States, and that leverage has increased as global stockpiles continue to decline. In early May, Mr. Trump announced a military operation, Project Freedom, to assist ships going through the strait, but soon ended it, partly because of objections from Saudi Arabia. Since then, U.S. Central Command has guided ships through, but has stopped short of providing a naval escort. In a social media post on Wednesday, Mr. Trump said more than 200 commercial vehicles had traveled safely through the strait. "This wildly successful effort is because the United States of America controls the Strait of Hormuz, not Iran," Mr. Trump said. A senior U.S. military official confirmed that number and said the passages had taken place over roughly 5 weeks. "This suggests that some 6 ships a day went through with coordination by the United States. Before the war, around 130 vessels passed through each day. It is close to impossible for independent ship tracking firms to check the U.S. totals, because the ships are turning off their tracking devices when going through the strait with American support. The ship tracking firms have other ways of following vessels, but those methods can take longer to complete." Mr. Trump also said the U.S. effort had resulted in more than 100 million barrels of oil going through the strait. He did not say when the shipments took place, and a White House spokeswoman did not provide the dates when asked. Assuming the oil shipments occurred over 5 weeks, the period provided by the U.S. official, they would work out to nearly 3 million barrels a day. Before the war, roughly 18 million barrels were being shipped through the strait per day, according to Demetrius M. Pazidakis, a maritime risk and compliance manager at Kepler, a ship-tracking company. A U.S. military helicopter was downed on Monday in the strait. A U.S. official said it had been on patrol, not guiding ships. Still, the episode showed the risk that U.S. forces might face when helping ships get through, and some analysts said the relatively small amount of oil getting through may not justify the dangers involved. "It's a risky trickle," said Rosemary Kalanick, a director at Defense Priorities, a research organization focused on foreign affairs. "Iran has sought to establish itself as the controller of a ship traffic in the strait by requiring that ship operators gain Tehran's permission to pass. Some vessel operators, eager to get their ships out of the Persian Gulf safely, have complied and taken routes through the strait that run close to Iran's coast." This month, Iran said more than 300 non-Iranian ships, mostly tankers, had requested safe passage through the strait since early May. Separately, Kepler estimated that of the 895 crossings of the strait from March 1 to May 19, just over half were done on the Iran route. To loosen Iran's grip on the strait, the United States set up a blockade in mid-April against Iranian and Iranian-linked ships, aiming to prevent the country from exporting oil through the waterway. From the start of the war until the blockade, Iran was exporting significant amounts of crude through the strait, and far more than any other Gulf state. In that period, around 1.9 million barrels of crude a day were going through the waterway, three-fourths of which were from Iran, according to data from Vortexa, which tracks energy shipments. From mid-April until June 1, the shipments fell to 1.2 million barrels a day, as Iran's exports plunged and those of some Gulf states increased, according to Vortexa's data. While the blockade seems to be working, the data indicated that it is causing less Gulf oil to get out through the strait, aggravating the global crude shortage. Blockading Iran and preventing their oil from coming to the market hurts the whole market, Ms. Kalanick said. In enforcing its blockade this week, U.S. forces struck a tanker, India's shipping minister said. Three Indian seamen on the tanker had died. The crew repeatedly failed to comply with directions from U.S. forces, said Captain Tim Hawkins, Central Command spokesman. We issued warnings prior to the disabling shots. Wages are falling, wealth is surging. No wonder Americans are unhappy. As Elon Musk became the world's first trillionaire, workers are facing higher prices and fears of AI-driven job losses. By Ben Castleman. Two events from the past week help crystallize this strange, contradictory moment for the U.S. economy. On Wednesday, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the surge in energy prices had wiped out a year and a half of wage gains for the average American worker. On Friday, the public markets debut of SpaceX made Elon Musk the world's first trillionaire. That stark juxtaposition helps explain why many Americans, in survey after survey, say they no longer believe the U.S. economy is working for them. A few people are getting fabulously, unimaginably wealthy at the same time that the entire generation of families worried they will never be able to afford to buy a house, raise children, or enjoy a comfortable retirement. I don't think the stock market is necessarily causing Americans' pessimism about the economy, said Stephanie Stantacheva, a Harvard professor who studies public sentiment. But I don't think people are looking at it and are thinking, great, this means I'm going to do very well, too. It's potentially reinforcing this feeling of I'm falling behind. Inequality is hardly a new feature in America, but the explosion of wealth at the very top is without precedent in U.S. history. At the height of the Gilded Age, at the end of the 19th century, the richest handful of Americans had a net worth equivalent to about 3% of the country's annual economic output, according to data compiled by the French economists Gabriel Zucman and Emmanuel Saez. Today, the fortunes of the same 0.00001%, about 20 individuals, makes up roughly four times as large a share, equivalent to 12% of annual output. Other economists, using different methodologies, come up with somewhat different numbers, but hardly anyone disputes the basic fact that the wealthiest few have made extraordinary gains in recent years. The picture for the other 99% of Americans is more nuanced. More than half of the U.S. households own stock, either directly or through retirement accounts, meaning they have benefited at least somewhat from the record-setting run-up in share prices. Wealth has risen more slowly for middle-class families than for the rich over the past decade. Federal Reserve data shows, but it has still risen. For most Americans, however, wealth is a somewhat abstract concept, tied up in the house where they live and the retirement accounts they hope to leave untouched for as long as possible. What matters more day-to-day is their income, and the share of national income going to workers has been trending down for decades. It hit a record low in the first quarter of the year, according to data from the Commerce Department. Now, rising costs are again taking a bite out of workers' paychecks. The recent jump in energy prices, a result of the war with Iran, pushed the annual inflation rate to a three-year high in May. Hourly wages adjusted for inflation have fallen for 3 months in a row, erasing all the gains made during President Trump's first year in office. Measures of consumer sentiment have plummeted as gas prices have risen. Oil prices have eased somewhat in recent weeks on hopes of a lasting ceasefire, and are likely to fall further if the United States and Iran reach a deal and tankers begin to move out of the Persian Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz in greater numbers. But relief at the pump is not likely to end Americans' anxiety after years of one economic shock after another. First, the COVID-19 pandemic shut down large parts of the economy and put tens of millions of people out of work, at least temporarily. Then inflation soared to the highest level in four decades. Since then, Americans have endured high interest rates, tariffs, and repeated recession scares. If you think about what it felt like to go through COVID and then inflation and also political unrest and instability, you come out of those things thinking, how am I supposed to plan for the future? Said Elizabeth Wilkins, president of the Roosevelt Institute, a left-leaning think tank. Mrs. Stantcheva, the Harvard economist, has found that bouts of high inflation take a long-term toll on consumers' economic attitudes. That is not only because of the strain on their budgets, but also because it seems unfair. The wealthy are able to absorb higher prices relatively easily, while lower-income households struggle. It goes hand in hand with a big sense of inequity and injustice, she said. Now Americans face a new threat in the form of artificial intelligence, which tech industry leaders warn could eliminate whole categories of white-collar work. Many economists are skeptical of those predictions, but polls show that many workers are worried about what the technology will mean for their careers. Voters across the country have also rebelled against plans to build AI data centers in their communities, citing their impact on electricity bills, water supplies, and air quality. Given those concerns, it is hardly surprising that the public is uncomfortable with the surge in wealth that has accompanied the AI boom. Companies connected to the technology have driven the recent gains in the stock market. SpaceX's debut on Friday was the first in what is expected to be a series of giant initial public offerings for AI companies. SpaceX, though best known for its rockets and satellites, also owns an AI lab and has made huge investments in AI infrastructure. In addition to making Mr. Musk a trillionaire, the SpaceX IPO alone was expected to mint thousands of new millionaires and several billionaires. Many of the tech moguls who are the current super rich have not helped themselves in the conversation by saying, "My innovation is going to obliterate your life," said Glenn Hubbard, an economist at Columbia Business School, who served as a top advisor to President George W. Bush. "It's not too crazy to imagine a backlash." Mr. Hubbard said he did not necessarily see a problem with the existence of billionaires or even trillionaires as long as people were getting rich through entrepreneurship and innovation rather than through corruption or cronyism. But he said policymakers should take the public attitude seriously. Congress should consider ways to tax billionaires more effectively, he said, and to ensure that the wealthy don't exert undue influence on the political system. Many progressive economists, however, argue that enormous fortunes like Mr. Musk's inherently distort both the economic and the political systems, giving the super-rich too many ways to avoid regulation, taxation, and oversight. It's the power to influence markets. It's the power to buy competitors. It's the power to influence policymaking, said Mr. Zuckman, one of the French scholars of wealth inequality. If you want a well-functioning market economy, it's not good to have too much concentrated power with extreme wealth at the very top. It distorts markets. It distorts democracy. The AI boom is still in its nascent stages, and some analysts are skeptical that SpaceX and other companies will earn profits to justify their sky-high valuations. If the doubters are right, share prices could fall, and Mr. Musk's trillionaire status could prove short-lived. But such a decline could have consequences for ordinary Americans as well. AI-related investments have helped carry the economy through a tumultuous period. The stock market boom has helped prop up consumer spending as wage growth has cooled. A bursting of the AI bubble would put millions of jobs in jeopardy, from the electricians wiring data centers to the waiters serving wealthy investors in high-end restaurants, and it would vaporize trillions of dollars in paper wealth held in 401k accounts and college savings plans. That can make AI feel like something of a catch-22 for workers. If the technology succeeds in reshaping the economy, they could lose their jobs. If it fails to live up to the hype, their retirement savings could evaporate. No wonder so many Americans feel that the economy is rigged against them, said Heather Bauschi, who served as an advisor in the Biden administration and has written a book about the economic impact of inequality. Clearly, our economy is designed to create a handful of billionaires and a trillionaire, Ms. Bauschi said. It is no longer about creating opportunity and stability for the majority. Phil Mickelson's golf club membership revoked after alleged misconduct with employee by Brody Miller and Alex Andreyev. Phil Mickelson, winner of six major championships and one of the most well-known golfers of his generation, had his membership revoked from his longtime club after an independent investigation into alleged misconduct. The Farms, a club in Rancho Santa Fe, California, outside of San Diego, confirmed to The Athletic that it pulled Mickelson's membership. Golf Digest first reported the news Thursday. Golf Digest cited anonymous sources in saying the incident involved unwanted contact with a female employee of the club. A spokesperson for Mickelson did not comment directly on that allegation, but told the publication any misunderstanding has been cleared up. Phil continues to attend to a family health matter and is uncertain when he'll be able to return to professional golf. The Farms released a statement Thursday that it later told The Athletic was in reference to Mickelson. The Farms Golf Club is committed to maintaining a golf club environment that is safe, respectful, and reflects the highest standards of conduct. All members are required to adhere to our code of conduct, and any allegations of misconduct are taken seriously, the statement read. Following a staff member report of member misconduct, the club provided immediate and ongoing support to the staff member, conducted a thorough independent investigation of the incident, and took decisive action. This individual is no longer a member of the Farms Golf Club. The Farms, citing safety and privacy of our staff and members, declined to comment further. In a statement provided to The Athletic, the San Diego County Sheriff's Office said it has not received any reports of sexual assault at the Farms. The Sheriff's Office has made attempts to locate any evidence to support the potential allegations of a sexual assault, the statement read. At this time, we have not located any evidence to show an assault has occurred. The Sheriff's Office would absolutely investigate further if provided additional evidence or information. Mickelson announced in April he would miss the Masters and step away for an extended period as my family continues to navigate a personal health matter. Mickelson has played just once since August, missing four of the first five LIV golf events this season. He did not qualify for next week's U.S. Open, and his five-year exemption from winning the 2021 PGA Championship has expired. When Mickelson missed the first two LIV events of the season, he said on social media, "I will not be able to participate in the first two LIV events, as wife Amy and I need to be present for a family health matter. I can't wait to compete again and look forward to rejoining my teammates as soon as possible." For decades, Mickelson was a beloved, fast-talking fan favorite who often got himself into trouble on the course, but usually found his way out of it. His win at the 2021 PGA at 50, making him the oldest major winner in golf history, seemed to be a perfect capstone to his career. Instead, Mickelson has become more divisive in recent years, better known for his large role in golf's Civil War and the creation of the LIV Golf League. In 2016, Mickelson was named as a relief defendant in an SEC insider trading scandal involving professional gambler Billy Walters, a longtime associate of Mickelson's. the SEC accused Dean Foods corporate director Thomas Davis of leaking information to Walters, who then urged Mickelson, who owned Walters gambling debts, who owed Walters gambling debts, to buy Dean Foods stock in 2012. Mickelson made $931,000 from these trades and used it to partially pay back Walters. Because the investigation lacked evidence that Mickelson knew the tip was illegally obtained, Mickelson evaded charges, but he paid a $100,000 fine and returned his profits to the SEC. In 2022, as Mickelson was involved with the Saudi Public Investment Fund, launching LIV as a rebel golf league, the golfer was quoted by reporter Alan Shipnick as saying, We know they killed Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi and have a horrible record on human rights. They execute people over there for being gay. Knowing all of this, why would I even consider it? Because this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to reshape how the PGA Tour operates. Public backlash followed, and Mickelson lost longtime support sponsors, KPMG and Amstel Light. He then announced he was stepping away from golf to spend time with family. He missed the Masters and PGA Championship, in which he was the defending champ, in 2022, and never played another PGA Tour event before joining LIV in June 2022, and was suspended by the PGA Tour for playing in a conflicting event without permission. Ebola comes for Congo's most vulnerable children. These Congolese children are re-entering the world after 5 days of isolation. It's the first year of their lives, and they're at the center of a deadly Ebola outbreak. The babies are all orphans who were brought to this hospital after showing symptoms of the virus. They've just tested negative and are being taken to a temporary home, but at least two other babies from the same orphanage have died. What happened to them has been a worst-case scenario for health officials trying to stop Ebola from spreading to young children. The alarms went off in late May here at St. Nicholas Children's Home after the arrival of a newborn girl, Patience, who quickly developed a fever. We were given a tour of the orphanage where nearly 70 children plus their caretakers live. A pediatrician tracked baby Patience's mother's case and learned that she had Ebola when she died. Days later, Patience died too. She was 9 days old. This was taken while she was still alive. It's unclear whether the family knew she could be infected. The relatives who brought her to St. Nicholas declined to talk to us when we reached him by phone. By the time anyone in the orphanage understood the danger, some of the staff had already held and cared for Patience. Soon, more children were showing symptoms of the virus. When we visited the Ebola treatment ward, a 10-month-old seemed to be getting better. Baby Elisa was being cared for by Sister Cecile Nube, one of three staff members at the orphanage who also tested positive. Even while sick herself, Sister Nube stayed by Elisa's side, feeding her, giving her medicine, and watching over her. Elisa died 24 hours after we met her, a reminder of how quickly the disease can turn, especially for babies. Now, St. Nicholas is under quarantine. Every day, contact tracers visit the orphanage, check the children and their caretakers for fevers. Some of them today are presenting a little bit higher temperature, but they are okay at the moment. The concern is that one infection here could quickly become many. It could have been a recipe of disaster. It's a very classic situation where Ebola can very fastly devastate the community. They're playing together and they're spending the whole day together, so it's spreading from one person to the next. And for zero time, you'll see the entire community being infected. For now, the orphanage remains under watch. It's still a refuge for children who need shelter and care, even as every new symptom raises the fear that the virus could still be spreading. Trump's big new vulnerability in 2026, blue-collar white voters. A review of polling data show an extraordinary swing among white working-class voters on the president's handling of the economy. By Shane Goldmacher. The last time President Trump faced a midterm election in 2018, congressional Republicans were dragged down by his unpopularity and lost more than three dozen House seats. But even in defeat, the bottom never truly fell out for the Republicans that year. The party actually gained ground in the Senate, as working-class white voters largely kept their faith in Mr. Trump's economic know-how. Today, that once deep reservoir of goodwill has largely evaporated. Blue-collar white workers are, for the first time, seriously doubting Mr. Trump's handling of the economy. A review of polling by the New York Times shows an extraordinary swing on that issue among white voters without college degrees between his first midterm election and now. Then, working-class white voters approved of his management of the economy by margins of 30 percentage points or even more. Now, recent polls show them disapproving by anywhere from 14 to more than 30 points. Mr. Trump's approval on the economy has dropped across practically every group, but his cratering support among a loyal demographic that has served as the foundation of his political coalition for a decade has the potential to be among the most consequential developments of 2026, according to interviews with strategists in both parties who are involved in the midterms. Polls now regularly show that a majority of white voters who did not graduate from college no longer approve of Mr. Trump's handling of the economy. Examples of his low ratings include polls from Fox News, 33% approval, CBS News, 39%, NPR, PBS, Marist, 40%, CNN, 43%, and the New York Times Siena College, 47%. In other words, he has lost the faith of his most loyal supporters on the year's most pressing issue. Mr. Trump's advisors are actively pressing to shore up support, trying to sell policies in last year's tax cut package. The Treasury Department this month released a new report detailing how workers benefited from the tax bill. And then this past week, Mr. Trump's $350 million super PAC, MAGA Inc., put out its first statement since the 2024 election. The topic was telling how tax cuts specifically help the working and middle class. It's a working class voters who are not happy with the Republican Party, and they may not come out and vote. John McLaughlin, a Republican pollster who has worked for Mr. Trump for years, warned in an interview. He said he had seen backsliding of Mr. Trump's gains in 2024 among working-class black and Hispanic voters, too. At this point, one of the only groups still supporting him on the economy in polls are Republicans. Democrats are moving to capitalize, drawing up plans to compete in new places that not long ago had seemed too demographically daunting. More white and rural electorates in states such as Iowa that have trended Republican for years. The Democratic brand, however, remains deeply tarnished among working-class white voters. Polls show many of them have not yet moved all the way towards saying they will vote for Democrats this fall. Alex Pfeiffer, a MAGA Inc. spokesman, said Democrats would be forced to defend their record on immigration and opposition to the president's tax bill. Democrats will have to explain why they voted to take more money from tipped and overtime workers, as well as seniors on Social Security, he said. Yet even more muted turnout from a blue-collar white voters who voted more than 2-1 for Mr. Trump in 2024 could imperil his party's chances in November. It's critical, Mr. McLaughlin, the Trump pollster said, of mobilizing the white working class. If they don't, we lose the House and the Senate. A watershed moment. Mr. Trump stormed back power in 2024, promising to stop illegal immigration, tame inflation, and rev up the economy. He won 66% of white blue-collar votes, according to exit polling, the exact share he received in his first election in 2016. Yet in the months since his second inauguration, Mr. Trump's pursuit of tariffs, persistently high prices for gas and groceries, his focus on foreign affairs, particularly the war in Iran, and ongoing inflation, appear to have sapped that support, even as border crossings have plunged. The biggest problem is they have been driven and continue to be driven by the cost of living pressure, said Robert Blizzard, a Republican pollster. Prices, stagnant wages, and anxiety over when the next shoe is to drop. Molly Murphy, a Democratic pollster who worked on former Vice President Kamala Harris's 2024 campaign, said the change had been striking. After he started the war in Iran, people in focus groups who had voted for him and were working class were at a loss for words to try to explain or justify this action. "And feel directly impacted because of gas prices," she said. "In the decade of Trump being in our lives, it feels like a watershed moment of them reckoning with him not being the person they thought he was." Tim Spencer, a retired tool and die maker who lives in Pella, Iowa, previously voted for Mr. Trump, but higher gas prices are making him feel squeezed. That, along with the president's increasingly erratic behavior, have left him no longer supporting Mr. Trump. The cost of filling his Chevy pickup truck has risen to around $140 from $90, he said. In past summers, Mr. Spencer, 72, and his wife pulled a camper to campsites throughout the Midwest. "With the price of gas now, it's an Iowa camper," he said. Many voters have given Mr. Trump the benefit of the doubt for years, particularly on economic issues. In his first term, they trusted the image he had cultivated as a decisive business executive hosting The Apprentice. They fondly remembered the country's economy under his watch when he ran again in 2024. Back in 2018, his party losses among Trump voters instead were concentrated in other demographic groups, especially more upscale suburban women. On the eve of the 2018 midterms, Mr. Trump's approval rating on the economy still stood at 66% among white voters without college degrees, according to a CNN poll. That was one reason that while Republicans lost the House that year, the party still knocked off four Democratic incumbents in the Senate. This term, Mr. Trump's approval on the economy, an issue that strategists in both parties agree is the most pressing of the 2026 elections, has plunged even deeper than his approval overall. Mr. Trump's disapproval on the economy among those same voters was at 51% in CNN's most recent poll. Surveys that dive more deeply into questions around inflation or the cost of living are even bleaker for the president. Among blue-collar white voters, Mr. Trump's approval rating on the cost of living stood at just 36% in the Times survey. Fox News found that just 25% approved of his handling of inflation. There were certain things that he had made promises on the campaign trail that just didn't come to fruition, said Carl Wallner, 35, who lives outside Fort Worth. He considers himself more libertarian and voted for Mr. Trump in 2024 based on those promises. He was talking about, you know, lowering gas prices. Gas prices are up. Mr. Wallanu has more jobs in the gig economy as a stagehand in a comic store and setting up events, but described himself as struggling to really thrive. He now plans to vote for a third party in 2026. "I'm reminded of Bill Clinton," Mr. Wallner said, "in the economy. It's the economy, stupid. I don't think about Americans' financial situation." Democrats said they were seeing some early signs of success. Eva Kemp, strategist with American Bridge, a Democratic group with a super PAC and a research arm, has spent recent years laboring to find disillusioned Trump supporters to feature in Democratic ads. "It has gotten easier," she said. "The process involves sitting through focus groups and listening to people air their grievances. It almost feels more visceral in their disappointment and their willingness to go against President Trump," she said, adding that women in particular have run out of patience. In one recent focus group of working-class white voters in Iowa, nearly all the women gave Mr. Trump a D or an F. The white men graded him higher. Some Republican strategists granted anonymity to discuss their party's vulnerabilities said they were seeing the same gender phenomenon among white working-class voters. "Democrats don't need to carry white working-class voters to reclaim power in November. Simply losing them by less could deliver major wins this fall." In the most recent NPR PBS News Marist poll, 44% of white voters who didn't graduate from college said they were more likely to vote for a Democratic congressional candidate this year, up from a meager 30% on the eve of the 2018 midterms. Mr. Trump is not helping matters with his dismissive talk about the economic concerns of so many Americans. "I love the inflation," he said in the Oval Office this past week. Previously, he waved off rising gas prices as peanuts and said when speaking about the timing of winding down the war in Iran, "I don't think about Americans' financial situation." The latter quote is already featured in Democratic ads, such as one targeting Representative Rob Bresnahan in Pennsylvania that uses the line three times from three camera angles in the opening 12 seconds, interspersed only with the words gas, groceries, and utilities. Remaking the map for 2026, in 2018, the Democrats' path to the House majority ran heavily through well-educated and wealthier enclaves of the country. The party picked up four seats in Orange County, California, as well as seats outside Chicago, Minneapolis, New York, Atlanta, and Washington, D.C. You could basically sort a list of districts by college education, and the higher up you were on the list, the more likely you were going to vote for a Democrat, said Mike Smith, who heads the top super PAC for House Democrats. But 2026 allows Democrats to compete in areas the party has left fallow for years. The Senate map is made up of white working-class voters, said Ms. Murphy, the Democratic pollster. You just aren't going to win in Iowa, Texas, Ohio, and Maine without making inroads with white working-class voters. Mr. Trump's transformation of the Republican Party to be more blue-collar means that voters have been inspired to vote for him, said Mr. McLaughlin, the Trump pollster. The problem, he noted, is that the president is no longer on the ballot. He took the country club Republican Party and gave it to the caddies, Mr. McLaughlin said. Ultimately, the party's chances will live and die with Mr. Trump's ability to reconnect with his disillusioned white working class base, said Neil Newhouse, a veteran Republican pollster. The one guy who can energize them is the reason why they're not energized right now, he said, which is Trump. SpaceX's unlikely journey from far-out idea to $2 trillion juggernaut. Elon Musk said he initially given SpaceX less than a 10% chance of succeeding. His rocket company has come a long way. About 25 years ago, Adi Oressi, a former college roommate of Elon Musk, begged the tech entrepreneur not to start a rocket company. Mr. Musk had just reaped millions of dollars from the sale of PayPal, which he helped create, to eBay. He and Mr. Ressi were looking at ways to send terrestrial plant life to Mars. They had a $50 million budget, but soon found it was not enough to cover the cost of a rocket, so Mr. Musk told his friend that he was going to build his own. Mr. Ressi said he had organized a panel of space experts one day in a conference room of a hotel in Santa Monica, California, and brought Mr. Musk in to hear why the idea was a fool's errand. Private spaceflight was expensive and the economics made little sense, the dozen or so people there said. But Mr. Musk did not heed them. I really want to congratulate him for the incredible perseverance, Mr. Ressi said in an interview, for making it happen. Mr. Musk's rocket company, SpaceX, has come a long way since Mr. Ressi's failed intervention. On Friday, SpaceX debuted on the stock market as the world's largest initial public offering, a $2 trillion juggernaut that has launched hundreds of rockets into space, operates a dominant satellite internet service, Starlink, and oversees Mr. Musk's artificial intelligence efforts and social network X. The company's IPO was so huge that Mr. Musk became the world's first trillionaire. Yet SpaceX's success was never a sure thing. Mr. Musk and his team of executives and engineers overcame numerous hurdles, solving problems as varied as the physics of rockets and the connection of multiple satellites in orbit. Mr. Musk acknowledged how far-fetched SpaceX's achievements were. At the company's Starbase headquarters in Texas on Friday for the IPO, the 54-year-old said he had given SpaceX less than a 10% chance of succeeding. "I told people this. It's probably going to fail, but we should give it a try," he said. Mr. Musk's space dreams were initially modest and centered on sending some seeds to Mars in a small greenhouse through a venture he had started with Mr. Ressi. Life to Mars, he thought, that if people on Earth saw green sprouts pushing up on Mars, they'd be excited enough to push Congress to give more money to NASA. So Mr. Musk traveled to Russia, hoping to find an old intercontinental ballistic missile that could cheaply launch the greenhouse into space. It's a stunning story, said Mr. Cantrell, who became SpaceX's fourth employee. Now we see today what it became, but at the time it seemed rather inconsequential. In SpaceX's early years, it alternated between eye-catching failures and resounding successes. The company's first rocket, the Falcon 1, was small. Its first two launches from the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean failed. SpaceX was starting to run out of money. At that point, Mr. Musk said he would try one more time to make the rocket work, recalled Robert Zubrin, aerospace engineer and a former friend of Mr. Musk's. The third try also failed, but Mr. Musk then said he would try again. If it failed a fourth time, he might have given up entirely, Mr. Zubrin said. That would have been the end of SpaceX, he said. In September 2008, the fourth Falcon 1 launch made it to orbit. So did a fifth nearly a year later. By then, SpaceX had won a key contract from NASA to develop the much larger Falcon 9 rocket and the accompanying Dragon capsule to take cargo to the International Space Station. The first Falcon 9 launch in 2010 reached orbit, as did the second 6 months later. In 2014, SpaceX won another major NASA contract to take astronauts, not just cargo, to the space station. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe and thank you for listening.